Daf Zayin Amud Alif. This is an experiment for the sound. We heard that it might work better. Okay. Daf Zayin Amud Alif. We are 2, 4, 6, 8. The ninth widest line, the ninth wide line. Second word on the line is Hahut Tzeduki. Okay? There was a Tzeduki. Now let's just remember what we're up to here. The Gemara had told us that there is an instant in the day where Hashem grows angry. Kviyachol. That's a time of Midas Hadin. And that if you want to pinpoint that moment, you can see it by watching a rooster. At that time, at that instant in the day, a rooster stands on one foot and its crown pales. Its crown goes white. For a second, that's the second that Hashem gets angry. Kviyachol. Mufarshim explain that the rooster actually represents Midas Hadin for whatever reasons. That's why we use the rooster for kaparis, by the way. Rooster is called a gever, which is from the same word as gevura. Gevura represents Midas Hadin. There's chasadim and gevuras, the two sides of the scale. Chesed is chesed, gevuras is din. That's parenthetical. But whatever.
And the red and white lines, the color of the lines, why?
Why does it have to do with the color? I don't know. Now, how, based on this, right? Yeah, but I still don't know how that would tie into the anger aspect. I don't know. So now, based on this, there was a tzeduki in the neighborhood of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. He used to always bother Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi with psukim. I mean, he would always like to debate with Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, and he would always, the debates would always be based on all kinds of twisted construals of psukim. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi was getting sick of it. One day, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi knew this, what we just saw. Shokal Tarnegoyle. He decided, you know what? I'm going to tap into this anger moment. He took a rooster. Ukme ben Karida Arsa. He tied him to his bed. Ve'inbe. And he sat, he figured he's going to invest the morning in this. He sat there, he wanted to sit there for 3 hours in the morning. Sit on his bed and watch the rooster and catch the moment when his crown pales to curse this fellow. Sabar, he figured, Kimota Ishata, when that moment hits, I'll curse him. Kimota Ishata, when the time hits, Nayan, when Yeshua ben Levi fell asleep, he missed it. Omar, so Yeshua ben Levi was a conscientious person. He didn't just say, all right, I missed this time, I'll try again tomorrow. He took that as a message. He said, Shema minolav oirach ar lemebad hochi. Apparently, it is not appropriate to do this. Verachamov al kol ma'asov ksiv. It says that Hashem's mercy encompasses all of His creations, and therefore this is not a thing to do. Uksiv. And it also says, Gam anoish la tzadik loitoy. It's not good for a tzaddik to punish people. Okay. So he dropped his idea. He abandoned.
Why do we need both reasons?
What's that?
Why do we need both reasons?
He was approaching it from two different angles. Let's explain what actually happened there. First of all, it's time we have to understand this. First of all, Tosfos asks the question. A tzaddiki is an apikoros, a min, what we call in the Gemara. It says about minim. That if you see a min drowning, you walk by and you see a min drowning, help him down. That's what it says about minim. Now, if so, what was the problem with Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi did? And by the way, we have to note that meant in their times. It doesn't mean in our times when people grew up not knowing better. The Chazon Ish makes that very clear. It meant when a person blatantly went and wantonly dropped Yiddishkeit, defied Yiddishkeit, fine, not now at times. Whatever it is, Tosfos says, well, it's a problem. Halacha, you're supposed to do this. That's question number one. Question number two is, there are plenty of cases throughout Shas of Talmud Chacham striking someone to death with the word of his mouth or in other such forms by putting his eyes upon him. Shas is full of that. What's the problem here? So Tosfos says, and this is basically what the Mepharshim say in general, that yes, if there's a din that you're supposed to kill a min, it's like all other halachas and mitzvahs in the Torah that you're supposed to work within the normal derech hateva to do it. Not supposed to invoke miracles to do these things. Davening, that something should happen, which is what a normal curse is. What is a normal curse? What's a bracha and what's a curse? It's a tefillah that something should happen. That's still considered working within the normal bounds of derech hateva. Tefillah is considered a classic form of hishtadlus. But to actually manipulate koiches of spirituality, spiritual forces that you know exist, that's not what we're meant to do. That's outside the realm of our avodah. We're not meant to be mekayim mitzvahs by manipulating the upper worlds. That he shouldn't have done. That's what was wrong here. You can kill him? Kill him. If you can't kill him, don't. Meaning, in a situation where you are not in position to carry out the halacha of killing a min, then leave it up to Hashem to decide if he should die or not. Don't you invoke spiritual powers to kill him. That's what's being said here. Therefore, in other situations where a Moira or a Tana just issued a curse, fine. Because a curse at the end of the day is like a tefillah, you're leaving it up to Hashem to decide. When you're actually pushing spiritual buttons, pushing buttons of the upper world, that's not something we do. That's why in general, what they call practical Kabbalah is very, very discouraged and avoided. We don't see any of the great Mikubalim that we knew of engaging in these things. Okay, we move on. So now, he was actually approaching it from two angles. That's also the answer to Reuven's question. Why did he quote two psukim? Saying there are two different reasons why not to do this. First of all, once it's not up to us to punish this guy, we shouldn't, so to speak, force Hashem to punish it. I can't do it, so I'll twist Hashem's hand. No, Rachamav HaKol Ma'asav, Hashem is allowed to decide to have mercy on a person. Bezdin is supposed to kill him. If we're supposed to kill him, fine. But if not, then Hashem could decide that for whatever reason he's not killing him now. You don't have to mix into that once you don't have the natural means of doing it. That's number one. And number two is Anayish LaTzadik LoTov. It's not to a tzaddik's credit to be implementing punishments. Again, if there's a chiyuv al pi halacha, you have to do it. But when not, it's not considered to a tzaddik's credit to be implementing punishments. Okay, we move on. Some of the Rav Avraham is asking, what happens if this is a person who's really a danger to the public? So some of the Mepharshim do say also that that was taka part of the problem here, that he had a personal problem with this Tzaddik. This was annoying him immensely with all of his debates, but he didn't constitute a danger to the public. In these other cases, it was when the person was more problematic to the public in general. Yeah, you're right. Okay. By the way, okay, the Mepharshim, they add some more aspects on this. Again, what the difference between Rabbi Shab and Levi and other people who might have done this is. Also, Mepharshim just give a more general approach that when Hashem is in a matzav of kas, just stand away. Right? It's one thing if you're davening, you issue a klala. Tzaddik deems it necessary to issue a klala, to issue a curse. Fine. When you know that Hashem is bekas, it's not a time to present yourself before Hashem. It's not a time to say, oh Hashem, you're angry now. Why don't you hit that person? That's a classic thing. It's the sort of thing Mamash in the Gemara says, you bring din shamayim upon yourself. you're brave enough to present yourself before Hashem when you know that He's Bikas? Let's check you out. That's kind of what Rabbi Shav and Levi was being told here. Not a good idea. Hashem did him a favor by making him fall asleep and just keep away when Hashem is Bikas. Okay, we move on. Tana Mishmei de Rabbi Meir. A braisa was cited in the name of Rabbi Meir. Mishaa Shachama Zairachas. Now, we're going to give a little more perspective on this whole idea of Hashem's anger. Okay? Shaa Shachama Zairachas. When, you want to know when it is that Hashem grows angry, or what it is that causes it? When the sun comes up. Like we said before, it's the first 3 hours of the day. That's when the sun is coming up. And all the kings, from east to west, put their crowns on their head. And they bow to the sun. That is when Hashem goes angry. That is, so to speak, what causes Hashem's anger. So now we have a perspective. We just kept seeing kind of without explanation that Hashem gets angry in the first three, at some point in the first 3 hours of the day. Now we're seeing what it is. It's because of the phenomenon of Avodah Zarah in the world. So now, here also, that would explain why it was like it then, when there was Avodah Zarah. But what about nowadays, when there is no Avodah Zarah, nobody's bowing down to the sun? So the Maharal, Kedarkoi, gives a deeper perspective on what's going on here. Basically, the Maharal and the Ben Ishchai said the same thing here, in order to understand what the point here is. Why kings? Why don't they just say when people bow down to the sun? Presumably, if the sun was worshipped, everybody was bowing down to the sun. So the Maharal and the Ben Ishchai say as follows. The sun, basically, when the day starts, the sun comes up, representing the source of everything, the source of all life. That's what the sun is, right? The sun is what enables life on this earth. The day comes up. When the day begins, it's like a new world is beginning. Life is being poured down onto this earth again, right? Source is sun is energy, which is the source of all life. And therefore, everything begins with the sun. The sun is the top force in nature. And all the other forces of nature work under the sun. The sun is the top force of nature. The sun is the if you believe that there's no Hashem, so to speak, what is the supreme power in the world? The sun. So therefore, the Maharal and the Ben Ishchai both say that that's what's going on here. The Maharal says it's not so much an issue of Avodah Zarah per se. What is Avodah Zarah? Avodah Zarah is believing in some other power. When people believe that the world runs just on nature, they don't believe in Hashem, that's termed in the Gemara as worshipping the sun. You worship nature, you consider yourself subject to nature, which is headed by the sun. That's what's meant when it says that they worship the sun. Now I, kings, the rest of the nation considers themselves subject to the king. So everybody considers themselves subject to the kings. The kings and to the sun. Kings consider themselves subject to the sun. So the king plus the sun represent that people consider themselves subject to the normal course of events. To nature, political decisions, right? What are the two things that affect our life? Natural phenomena, right? And the forces of nature and the forces of the world leaders. The kings. Those are the two forces that together affect our lives, control our lives. When people believe in that, that is our form of Avodah Zarah. That's what it is that angers Hashem. Therefore, it's when the sun comes up and it's not recognized as just a conduit of Hashem. It's seen as a power in and of itself that already starts the day off wrong. And that's why there's already a level of chaos in the world. Maharal says chaos is not a decision of Hashem, so to speak. Chaos is an automatic outcome of the world being distanced from Hashem. It's an automatic outcome of Hester. Let's remember, chaos is not an emotion by Hashem. Kas is, so to speak, emotive behavior. Things that Hashem does. Now really, all the problems in this world are not Hashem doing anything. On the contrary, it's Hashem withdrawing and problems develop. So what is Kas? When Hashem withdraws, problems happen. It's perceived as Hashem's wrath. That's really what Kas is. To Midas HaDin is. And Mela, it's just an automatic result of people not recognizing Hashem. There's a vacuum where Hashem is supposed to be. And that results in this Kas. That's how the Maharal explains this Gemara. Mela takes it a step further and he says, we saw earlier that back in the days of the Midbar, there wasn't this Kas. Why? He says, because this Kas was only relevant when the world could be perceived as just working within the confines of nature. It all begins with the sun and develops from there. In the time of the Midbar, however, the whole time there was supernatural things going on. There was man coming down every day. The sun wasn't where it began. Didn't begin with the sun. In the physical world, there were always things above the sun going on, and therefore there was no room for Kas. Nobody was stopping with the sun. Even if the nations of the world were, there was man coming every day. People were clearly connected to the higher sources. No. The point is not necessarily the nations, whether the nations of the world recognize it or not. The point is that there's the world in and of itself could be viewed as just a box of nature. At that time, it couldn't be. Even if not everybody saw the sun, or within the physical world, it expanded further than the sun. It expanded above the sun, directly to Hashem. There was a more direct revelation, involvement of Hashem in this world. It didn't stop with the sun. Today, you could stop with the sun. That's what causes the Kas. Meaning again, yes, the kings also. But it all boils down to the kings and the sun. They're the ones, the sun, meaning all the forces of nature, along with all decisions of the world leaders and of the kings, politicians. That's what sets our life. We don't realize that nature is just Hashem's shliach. Not even Hashem's shliach. Nature is just Hashem at work. The politicians, Pal Gemayim Lev Melech Be'ad Hashem, all the world leaders, it's Hashem implementing His plan by making them make their decisions. Then you're connecting to the real source. Hashem wasn't hiding. Exactly. Right. That's the point. Okay, so he finished the sugya with the real perspective on what this kas is about. The kas is about not recognizing Hashem. Wherever there's a vacuum, that's what Chilul Hashem really means, by the way. We always think of Chilul Hashem as going out, not the most superficial way of presenting it is acting not nicely in front of other people. Acting in a way, doing an aveira in front of other people. That's one very specific manifestation of Chilul Hashem. But what is the root of the concept of Chilul Hashem? A vacuum. Acting in a way from which it appears that there isn't Hashem. That's what Chilul Hashem is. That's why anywhere atheism is Chilul Hashem. Anywhere where there appears not to be Hashem is Chilul Hashem. So therefore, that's the idea here. Wherever a person could just stop with nature, think that that's where it begins and ends, that creates this vacuum. Chilul means vacuum, by the way. That's what chilul means, emptiness. Chalal, right? When they tell you that you have extra room to expand in your apartment, they call it a chalal, empty space. That's what Chilul Hashem is, where there's a vacuum of Hashem. So, when there's a vacuum, that automatically results in what we're calling here Kas. Yes. The same thing as Koil as opposed to Kodesh. Yes. It's a vacuum of where the Kedusha should be.
But this last part of it, when the kings get up, one could argue Hashem's anger lasts a 16th of a second. When the first king does, the last king does.
Oh, you're asking. If it's the period when the kings get up, the truth is, you're asking a good question. What do we mean when the kings get up? Which king? The answer is, it means the whole period when kings are getting up and doing their thing, which is 3 hours. You've already seen in earlier Gemaras, right, that kings get up over the first 3 hours of the day. So Stan is asking a mathematical question. Does a 16th of a second equal 3 hours? Here the Gemara is saying, basically saying it's 3 hours. Earlier we saw that even if we want to be more generous, it's a third of a second. So the truth is that Tzlach answers that question. Tzlach, he has other indications in the Gemara also, that when we talk about Hashem's anger period, there are two elements. There are 3 hours of potential anger. The 3 hours in which the king is getting up. Hashem actually manifests that anger in one instant within those 3 hours. Now when exactly that is might vary from day to day. That's why it says nobody was able to pinpoint that moment. What's so hard to pinpoint the moment? You know about the chicken, right? You know about the rooster. Watch him for 3 days with the timer. You know what you need to be Bilam for. So the Tzlach says no. What it means is that there were 3 hours in the day in which that instinct could be any given time. Might not be the same time today and tomorrow. That's why it was impossible to pinpoint. Bilam, every day, knew exactly when it was going to be. That was the chokmah of Bilam. So that's how the Tzlach puts it together. Yeah, before it happened. Each day he woke up, he would know when it was going to be. That was the... what the Gemara is pointing out, that Bilam was so unique. Nobody else in the world had that. It wasn't just that he was able to know the pattern. It really happened at a different time every day. Maybe depending on which king davened to the sun with the most kavana, I don't know. But that's how it worked. What's that? Ferchem Nevuah. We have it, right? Don't Chazal tell us? Like, come be Yisrael, Kemoshe. No Navi arose in Yisrael like Moshe. Ababuma Soilam come. But among the Goyim he did. Bilam was a Navi. In Nevuah he was of equal stature of Moshe Rabbeinu. Surprising thing. Hard to imagine. Now that has to be explained. Not now. Because he wasn't... he didn't receive Nevuah in the same way Moshe did. But in this level he actually had something Moshe didn't.
Hashem is never angry except in Israel?
No. So that also the Mepharshim say what this means is... there's no predictable anger. Hashem might grow angry in response to deeds. But the idea of a regular, predictable anger is only at this time. Okay. It's interesting to note, by the way, the Michtav Me'eliyot brings Rav Dessler. He points out a deep point here. He says, Bilam was okay. He was really good at his job. His job was manipulating, right? That was his thing. You know how to manipulate the Hashem's states, people call it that, right? What did Bilam do when his plan failed? He gave Balak an Eitzah. What was his Eitzah? Have them mess around with the daughters of Canaan. So Rav Dessler says, Bilam knew his job. He was trying, his whole koyach was to tap into Hashem's moment of anger. Bilam said, Kas is associated with Midas Hadin, as we discussed the other day. Bilam said, if there's no Midas Hadin these days, we can hit them from a different angle. If there's no Midas Hadin, that means that there's an abundance of Midas HaChesed. Taiva is associated with Chesed. We know that all of the great Midas have their perverted counterparts. Where they get to when they're perverted. Taiva is associated with Midas HaChesed. What is taiva? Taiva is immense pleasure done in the wrong way, in a perverted way. It stems from Midas HaChesed just when it's taken in the wrong way, when it's twisted around. So Bilam basically came and said, you know what? There's no Midas HaDin right now. That means that it's an especially auspicious time for tapping into taiva. It's a good time for taiva. Let's hit them with taiva. By the way, note, that's why, for example, it says about certain arayas, chesed hu. Right? That's certain arayas. Chesed hu, what does that mean? That's what it means. The very pragmatic aspect to this also. It's not just esoteric. Many of the therapists or counselors, people who deal with in the frum community, will often deal with trying to disband non-kosher relationships. Right? An interesting phenomenon is that often the difficulty will boil down to, so to speak, chesed. Meaning, I understand I'm ruining my family, and I understand I'm ruining the other party's family by continuing this business, but How can I do it to the other party? Beautiful, right? It just turns so politically correct and beautiful, right? I can't do it to the other person. You're able to do it to your family. You're wrecking your family through your behavior. But I can't do it to the other person. The taiva is a perverted, often goes along with a perverted form of chesed. There's a lot to that. It manifests in a lot of different very, very practical ways. Okay.
This then brought anger, real anger.
What's that? Right?
They went after the taiva. Then maybe Hashem.
Then they brought on midos hadin in abundance, right? Right, right. Yeah. Okay. That's what happened. Okay, we'll move on. Again, we're just bringing different various citations from Rabbi Yechon in the name of Rabbi Yehuda. Toiva mardus achas belibo shel odom. One true feeling of regret in a person's heart can go a lot further. Yoitzer mikama malchus, rather than go a lot further than many floggings. Meaning, you want to get a person to stop a certain behavior, sometimes a belt can go a long way, right? But when a person really senses true regret, that goes a lot further. Shenema, as it says in the apostle, v'rodfo esme ahavel. It says she will run after her lovers. This is apostle. A nevuah depicting Klal Yisrael when they're not loyal. So it depicts Klal Yisrael in the form of a disloyal woman, a disloyal wife. So it says she goes running after her lovers. But then ultimately, after she sees, she gets punished by Hashem, she gets betrayed by them. And then finally she says, Elcha v'ashuva al ishi arishan. I'll go back to my first man. Ki toivli oz me'ata. Because it was better for me then than now. And that's going to be more effective than the actual punishments. The punishments might bang a person into shape. But when you're talking about true internalization, for a person to really make a change of direction, when a person suddenly senses by himself, from within himself, that he's on a wrong path, that goes a lot further. That's why, just in general, we have to realize in chinuch, what?
Goes a lot further in what way?
What's that? In the person really changing his ways. That's why, for example, in chinuch, this is a very fundamental point in chinuch. People often engage in chinuch in controlling. You can make your kid do this, right? You're 35, he's 7, you're much stronger, or you have the power of withholding treats. You can get him to do what you want. Or you can stop him from doing what you don't want. Lock him in a room. You're not going to do it, right? Or give him a good spanking. Right? That'll discourage him. We have to realize that that's not chinuch. What is chinuch? This is really a very important point being brought out here in the Gemara. That might be an accessory of chinuch. But what is chinuch? Chinuch is defined in the pasuk. Chanoich lenar al pi dargo gam ki yazkin lo yosu mimen. You have to be machanech, a youth, at the beginning of his road, so that when he grows older, he won't depart from it. Now, by banging a kid into the shape all throughout the years of his childhood, you are not giving him any reason at all to want to continue that way when he's older. Often you're just doing the opposite. If he's a dumb enough kid, doesn't think anyways, might just continue with what he's used to. Okay. But is that what you want? Or do you want a vibrant kid who's making his own progress in Ruchnius, looking for his own aliyah? How do you get a kid to want to do that? Not by force. You have to use force, by the way. You have to use force. If you don't use force, you won't get anywhere. But that's not chinuch. Chinuch is, afterwards, helping the kid internalize it. That's what real chinuch is. Chinuch is when you manage to get the kid to feel with and to identify with what you were doing. So sometimes you have to use force. We have to realize that that force is not really chinuch. The chinuch is what comes in the internalization that you can manage to instigate afterwards. On a simple mashal, maybe I mentioned it. A simple example. you, a kid doesn't want to make a bracha. Okay? Let's say a 5-year-old kid doesn't want to make a bracha. You feel he's ready at the age that he should. Shkaya. Ready at the age that he should. You take the candy away until he makes the bracha. You need to do that. You need to do that. But you haven't yet been mechanichim, because that's not going to get him to make a bracha when he's 13. When he finally agrees, he gives in, he agrees, he backs down, and he makes that bracha, now you can be mechanich. Now that he made the bracha, now you launch into a whole phrase of what he did. You start telling him how great it was, you start telling him how happy you made Hashem. Now he feels good about what he did. Now you were mechanich. Sometimes you have to use the force in order to create the situation that will enable you to be mechanich. But that's what the Gemara is saying here, basically. The feelings that the person feels on his own are going to go a lot further in establishing his way of life than all the banging that you're going to do. Okay, we'll move on. Now, Reish Lakish Amar, Reish Lakish says, Geiser Mimea Malkis, it's more effective than 100 floggings. Shenemar, it says in the pasuk, Techas Ge'ara B'mevin, a scolding settles into an understanding person, Mehakois Kisil Mea, more than hitting a fool 100 times. Meaning you hit a fool 100 times, you might be able to train him to stop doing what you don't want him to do. When you manage to really get the message across to a kid who understands, to a person who understands, when you manage to hit his nefesh, get the message across, that's going to be much more effective than the 100 floggings that you give the other person. Okay. Now, Omar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Yosi. We're continuing to quote Rabbi Yochanan in the name of Rabbi Yosi. Now, this is also something of a continuation of the previous sugya, where we saw Hashem telling him, after the eagle, don't ask me things now, wait for my anger to subside, right? What was it that Moshe was trying to ask of him at that time? So now we'll see what it was he was asking of Hashem. It was already past the forgiveness, as we mentioned the other day. Hashem had already forgiven. Moshe had gone back up to figure out what's next. What was it that he was asking? Shloisha dvarim bikesh Moshe melefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Moshe requested three things of Hashem at that time. V'nosan lo. And Hashem granted all three. Bikesh shetishre shchina al Yisrael. He asked that the shchina should rest upon Yisrael. V'nosan lo. He granted him that. Shenema, as it says in the pasuk, Haloi belechtecha imanu. We want you to come along with us. That's our whole purpose. Bikesh sheloi tishro shchina alev dekechavim. He also asked that the Shechina should not rest upon the other nations. It should be exclusive. V'nosan lo. Hashem granted him that too. Shenema, as it says in the pasuk, V'niflino ani v'amcha. Me and your nation should become distinguished from the rest of the nations. Meaning, we should have your Shechina, but we should also be distinguished in that. We have it and they don't. Why is that a good thing? Good question. Let's see.
Did the Goyim ever have Hashem?
Let's see. Let's see. I'm going to put that on hold for momentarily. And the third thing that he asked was, Bikesh lo idiyoy d'rochav shel HaKadosh Baruch. He wanted to understand Hashem's ways, v'nosan lo. And Hashem granted him that too. Shenema says, Hoydieni noes d'rochecho. Please inform me of your ways. What was he asking? What was bothering him? Omar Lufanov, he asked him the classic question. Ribbono shel Olam, mipnei ma yesh tzadik v'tov loy, v'yesh tzadik v'ra loy. Why do some tzadikim have it good, and some tzadikim have it bad? Yesh rosho v'tov loy, v'yesh rosho v'ra loy. Why do some rishayim have it good, and some rishayim have it bad? That was Moshe's third question. Now, before we get on to the answer, let's just note the first two requests of Moshe, because that we're not going to spend much more time on. The Gemara is now going to get into the thick of this last aspect. But we saw Moshe had two requests. First of all, the Shekhinah should be upon us, and second of all, the Shekhinah should not be upon the nations of the world. So if Noach is asking, what does Moshe care? He can't share. What's the problem? So the truth is that what Moshe was asking was, the problem at the Chet HaEgel was that basically everything we had going up till now is falling apart. Right? Finished. So Hashem said, you know what, fine, it's not finished. I'm not going to wipe them out and they can go to Eretz Yisrael. You know what, I'm going to assign them a Malach. And Moshe was very unhappy with that. He said, no, that's not worth anything. We don't want a Malach, we want you. In other words, what was going on? Moshe had to build back up the relationship to what it was. Started out with direct relationship. Yani Amelech Chadorav, right? I'm not going to tell you what happened. It was a chuppah. It was a cheder yichud. Hashem and Klal Yisrael intimately together. Now what's Hashem saying? All right. I'll assign you a bodyguard. Leave me alone. So Moshe Rabbeinu was arguing to get it back to where it was. What was? So first of all, he said, I want Ashuas Hashchina. Ashuas Hashchina wasn't at all. Wasn't all. Wasn't everything that was before him. Ashuas Hashchina was, okay, Hashem will be with you. But Moshe Rabbeinu was really trying to reinstate what Avraham Avinu had reached, and that was that the Jewish people had become Hashem's family. Ashuas Hashchina could be for any righteous human being. Any righteous human being can connect to Hashem on a certain level. That's how it is. That's why in earlier times you had goyim who had Ruach HaKodesh. It was Eoiv, according to certain opinions. Goyim can reach high levels. When Moshe said we want it to be only us, he was asking for an even higher level. Not necessarily precluding the goyim from this lower level of Ashuas Hashchina, but he was saying, we now want that exclusive level, but we're not just connected to you, but we are Kaviyachol the family. That was what Avraham Avinu had earned. And Hashem was telling Moshe, I'll continue that with you. Not just that he was close with Hashem. Any human being can get close with Hashem. Malachim also are close with Hashem. Right? They're his ministers. But to be the family puts you on a completely different plane. Moshe was trying to get that back. Get back into that status. And we, with you, are just this exclusive unit. Nobody else can come close to because nobody else is family. And that's what we're being told here. Hashem granted because of Moshe's requests. We were brought back to our original state. Okay, now Moshe comes with the $1 million question. Why are there tzaddikim who have it good and tzaddikim who have it bad? We have Rishonim who have it good and Rishonim who have it bad. What's the answer? Omar lo. So Hashem answered Moshe. Tzaddik v'toivloi. Now this is going to be a hard answer to swallow. But let's see. Tzaddik v'toivloi. A tzaddik who has it good is tzaddik ben tzaddik. A tzaddik, the son of a tzaddik. Tzaddik v'raloi. Tzaddik who has it bad is tzaddik ben rasha. A tzaddik, the son of a rasha. Rasha v'toivloi. A Rasha as it could is Rasha ben Tzadik. A Rasha the son of a Tzadik. Rasha v'raloi. A Rasha as it bad is Rasha ben Rasha. A Rasha the son of a Rasha. Alright? Good? Everybody's comfortable with that? No? Okay, good. So the truth is, what's that?
It doesn't matter what you are.
Basically that's what Gemara is saying. What? Oh, so Rav Avraham is asking a very good question. If it's true, it's true. You know, that's the way Hashem runs things. That's the way Hashem runs things. You don't have to like it, right? So let's see. The Gemara is going to have a problem with it. But actually, as we'll see, there's more profundity here to what's going on. First, let's see. The Gemara is going to right away reject the simple understanding. Amamas. We had just said, Tzadik v'toivloi, Tzadik ben Tzadik. Tzadik was good is Tzadik the son of a Tzadik. Tzadik v'raloi, Tzadik ben Rasha. Tzadik was bad is Tzadik the son of a Rasha. So the Gemara says, Ini, can this be? Vaksiv, the Pasuk says, Vaked avoin avoy salbonim. There is such a thing of Hashem visiting the sins of the parents upon the children. Uksiv, but then there's a different pasuk that says the opposite. Ubanim lo yumsu al avos. This is a famous contradiction. Sons shall not die on account of their fathers. And the question has already been asked, how do we reconcile these two psukim? Does Hashem visit punishment upon the children because of the parents or not? And we've given the answer, it's not a contradiction, it depends. If the sons continue in the wayward ways of the fathers, they will suffer the consequences of their father's sins. But if the sons do not continue the derech of the fathers, they won't suffer from the father's sins. So how can you say that tzaddik v'raloi is a tzaddik ben rasha? Why would a tzaddik, the son of a rasha, suffer the consequences of his father's sins if he is not continuing in his ways? So Rabbi Avraham is right. The Gemara is not just asking why should it be that way. The answer to that would be because that's how Hashem works. You want to understand Hashem? But the Gemara is asking that a pasuk says otherwise. A pasuk says otherwise. So the Gemara answers, Elo hachika amale. You're right. Rather, what he meant to say was as follows: Tzadik v'toivloi, tzadik gom. A tzadik who has a good is a complete tzadik. Tzadik v'raloi, tzadik she'ena gom. A tzadik who has a bad is a tzadik who's not complete. Rabbi Yitzchok is not so comfortable with that either. Okay? Rosh of the Tevloi, that's valid. Rosh of the Tevloi, Rosh of Sheinai Gom. A Rosh who has a good is a Rosh who's not complete. He's working on it, but he still has some failings in his rishis. There are some things he still does right. Rosh of Eraloi, a Rosh who has it bad, is the Godol Hador of the Rishayim. Rosh Gamur, the full-fledged Rosh. Okay, now Rabbi Yitzchok doesn't like that answer either. Why not? You're leaving it to me to say why it bothers you. Okay, fair enough. So, first of all, it's a little too oversimplified. There were plenty of very great tzaddikim who suffered. So,
the debate
between the two of Yitzchaks. So he's saying, one minute, how can you say that? You know what a tzaddik gamur is? Maybe it's true. Every tzaddik gamur had a perfect life. Can a person ever tell that this person is a tzaddik gamur? It's a valid, that's true. Right? We don't know that there was a tzaddik gamur who suffered.
Didn't we have the concept before in the Gemara
of Yisurin Shalava? Okay, good. So the truth is here we're getting on to a much deeper discussion, which is really kind of reiterating the things that we've seen in that previous sugya of Yisurin Shalava, but there are some new angles on it. So first of all, we have to note something. The Braisa had said that the answer to the question was that it depends if you're a tzaddik ben tzaddik or a tzaddik ben rasha. And the Gemara comes along, asks the question, and says, so the answer is something else. There's no such thing. Gemara doesn't disagree with the Braisa. So what's going on here? So really, the Mefarshim say that the Gemara is actually explaining what the Braisa really meant. The answer of tzaddik ben tzaddik and tzaddik ben rasha remains, just that it has to be understood. It's not to be understood in the simple sense. Your tzaddik was a rasha, your father was a rasha, and therefore you suffer. It means something else. This is how the Al-Sheikh, and this is actually what it says in the Zohar. Tzaddik ben rasha doesn't mean biological, it means gilgulim. You know, there's such a concept called gilgul, reincarnation. I don't know how these things work, so don't ask me too many questions. But because the concept of Gilgal doesn't appear in Shas, it's the realm of the Zohar. But Tzaddik ben Rasha means that this is a Tzaddik coming from a Rasha in the sense of in his previous life he was a Rasha. That's what Tzaddik the son of a Rasha means. So therefore, Tzaddik ben Rasha, he's in this world and he's a righteous person, but he has things to rectify. He has things that he has to set right from the previous Gilgal. Therefore, he might suffer. He might suffer in order to atone for the problems in his previous Gilgal. Whereas a Tzaddik ben Tzaddik is a person who was perfectly righteous in his previous Gilgal as well, He's there for some specific reason. Apparently, Gilgulim is a complex subject. Must be. Sometimes a folklore tzaddik will come back too, but there's no reason for him not to enjoy this world. That's how the Zohar and the Al-Sheikh explain. And that's also what they mean by tzaddik gomor. That's really what the Gemara is explaining. Tzaddik gomor means a complete tzaddik. Meaning, he has no residue of rishus left from a previous life. That's a complete tzaddik. Yeah, perfect resume. Or, the truth is, what you're saying is, no resume is the perfect resume. Right? So that's the tzaddik gomor, tzaddik sheini gomor. That's the approach that basically the Zohar gives. The Al-Sheikh also gives this approach. But the truth is, I want to step back for a moment to analyze the subject a little more, because as we've seen back in the sugya of Yisur and Chalava, these are some very, very fundamental points to understand. Again, the Mepharshim basically take the approach that Rasha ben Tzadik, Tzadik ben Rasha, and Rasha ben Tzadik is not as inconceivable as it seems at first glance. And when the Gemara goes away from it, it goes away from it just to an extent. Meaning, the literal understanding that a tzaddik ben Rasha shouldn't suffer the consequences of his father, that's true. But there are still certain elements where the concept of tzaddik ben Rasha not having it as easy as a tzaddik ben tzaddik is true. For example, this is a very interesting point, an interesting distinction that the Maharshal makes. He says, in this world, for example, it's also a tough Rashi to swallow, but Rashi says back in the beginning of Parshas Tovos, Yitzchak and Rivka daven for children, right? And Hashem, it says in the Pasuk, Hashem listened to him. Rashi says to him and not to her. Why? Because she was the daughter of a Rasha. She was a Tzadikis, the daughter of a Rasha. Yitzchak was a Tzadik, the son of a Tzadik. There you see that this concept does apply. But the Maharshal says, one minute, there's another Gemara. There was a fast, there was a drought. Rabbi Eliezer Ben Hurkanus was sent to daven for the Yamun. Eliezer Ben Hurkanus was a Kohen, which means that he came from very great stock. Daven wasn't answered. Then they sent Rabbi Akiva. You know what Rabbi Akiva's lineage was about? Goyim. His grandfather was a Puerto Rican. I don't know about that, but... okay, but a Middle Eastern guy is not much better. So Rabbi Akiva got up, he was answered immediately. So the Gemara there gives an explanation, but the Maharshal says a very important distinction. He says, in this world, a person depends on Zchus Avos. A person depends on the merits of his fathers. And if he doesn't have that, he might have problems in this world. When it comes to inherent merit, however, a tzaddik ben Rasha is certainly greater than a tzaddik ben tzaddik. And therefore, he says, when Yitzchak and Rivka were davening for themselves, for their own benefit in this world, Yitzchak had zchus avos, he was quicker to be answered. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva were davening for the generation. They were davening for others. When it comes to davening for others, that depends on inherent zchus. When it comes to inherent zchus, the tzaddik ben Rasha had a bigger zchus than the tzaddik ben tzaddik. And therefore he was answered. You say you want to get a bracha from somebody, go to a tzaddik ben Rasha. But a tzaddik ben Rasha is davening for himself, might have a harder time than a tzaddik ben tzaddik. Very interesting distinction that the Maharshal says. So that logic remains. According to the Maharshal, that's lemaisa. Okay. What's that? The Schus HaRabim. He was davening for the Schus HaRabim. Already wasn't the personal issue. Oh, as long as they weren't children, it was still himself. It was his own. It was their own ambitions, right? Their own she'ifas. What? Yeah. Not necessarily. It could have been through a different woman. Hashem had already told Abraham, "Ki Yitzchak Yikoyel Chazora." Could have been through a different woman. Okay. Now, there are some other points to note here. Just first of all, Tzadik Gomor and Tzadik Sheinei Gomor, this is a very interesting point that Chassam Sofer makes, as far as the complete Tzadik and the incomplete Tzadik, the complete Rasha and the incomplete Rasha. Chassam Sofer and others, and the Netziv, and some of the Chassidish Sfarim make this point, basically all, each one in his way, but they're basically saying like this. A profound point. Tzaddikim don't have bad lives. They might have a lot of tzaras in their lives, but they're happy. A tzaddik veraloi, a tzaddik who has it bad, meaning a tzaddik who's miserable in life is not a complete tzaddik. Scary thing. A tzaddik who's miserable is not a complete... A tzaddik who has a lot of misfortune can be a complete tzaddik. But tzaddik veraloi means... Rally means he feels that he has it bad. A tzaddik who has a miserable life is not a complete tzaddik. A complete tzaddik only has a good life. He has a good life. He has a happy life. He has a happy life. Right? He has no complaints. Because he knows how to relate to anything that comes his way. Right? That's the famous story of Abzusha, that's right. Where somebody asked him, somebody asked his Rebbe, how can I work on being Mekabel Yisurim Ba'ava? How can I work on relating to misfortune in the right way? So he told him, that's a question they have to ask Abzusha of Anipoli, a famous Chassidish sage. They came to Abzusha, saw that he was living in abject poverty. My mom is very, very rough situation. The kids were sick. He saw that this was a person who had a very, very difficult life. They came in and he told them that I'm coming from my Rebbe. My Rebbe told me to ask you. You should give me a lesson in how to be Mekabel Yisurim Ba'av. And he's already thinking to himself, I see this is a good person to... Abzusha told him, he sent you to me? He said, yeah. I don't know why. I don't have misfortunes. Okay, he got his answer. That's the way that Chassam Sofer and the Netziv puts it into a little bit more perspective. He says, as long as a person hasn't completely refined his midas and his feelings in accordance with the way the Torah wants him to feel, he still will be suffering certain misfortunes. So it's interesting. Rav Shach also says such an idea. There's a psukim in the Teichacha say that when the Jews stray from Hashem, umitza'uhu tzarois rabois v'ra'ois, and very many and bad misfortunes will befall them. Many great and bad misfortunes will befall them. And then afterwards it says, "Vamru al ki ein eloi kai bekiyug mitzuni hatzorei sa'ila." Say, because Hashem is not with me, these misfortunes have come upon me. So Rav Shach said, one minute, in the previous pasuk, they were great and bad misfortunes. All of a sudden, in this pasuk, they're not great and bad anymore; they're just misfortunes. He said, as soon as they chap that it's al kein eloi kai bekiyug, as soon as they chap that it's because of my distance from Hashem, they realize that it's just an issue of their dynamics with Hashem. Oh, now they already understand. Now they understand what the issue is. Now they're already able to relate to it. Now I can make sense out of it. I'm not just lost. I'm not just drowning in misfortune. Misfortune, it remains, but it's not great and terrible anymore. Now I can already deal with it. Once I realize what the source of it is, it has to do with my distance from Hashem. As long as you don't realize that, they're great and terrible. Okay. That's that. Now just in general, I just want to put a general perspective that both the Ikarim and the Rambam make on these things. Everybody's bothered by the question. You always have people asking the question, why good people suffer, etc., etc. The Rambam says, yes, we see that the Gemara is granting this question legitimacy. And it's a legitimate question to a very, very, very limited extent. Because the Rambam says, in about 95% of the time, the question is not a question. Why? He says, first of all, most problems, this is harsh, this is the Rambam, the Karim says the same thing. Most problems that people suffer, they cause themselves. Right? Person doesn't look when he crosses the street, gets hit by a car, then he's in the hospital making cheshbon ha-nefesh, why did Hashem do this to me? Answer is, my friend, Hashem didn't do it to you, you did it to yourself. What lessons should I learn from this? What lessons should you learn? Look before you cross. And that's the answer. So don't ask, why is a tzaddik suffering? If a tzaddik shoots himself in the leg, he can't wonder, why is my leg broken? So the Rambam says, when you analyze, very often, it's the people who cause themselves the problems. The question is not in place. Now this is also not just necessarily a person out looking before he crosses. When a person doesn't know how to deal with other people, and he runs into troubles, right? And he makes enemies, and then they make him tzaras, Why did this happen? Why did this happen? Because you don't talk to people like a mensch. Why did this happen? Because you stabbed people in the back in the past. That's why it happened. Don't come with tainus on Hashem. In fact, the way he puts it is, Rabbi Avigdor Miller used to put it this way often also. He said, people come and they talk about a tragedy happens, which is clearly the result of carelessness. And people come and they talk about why Hashem did it. Rabbi Avigdor Miller used to yell, Haitzah Hashem Ra! Say, Haitzah Hashem Ra on Hashem. You! Didn't have bars on your window. It was very tough. You didn't have bars on your window and a tragedy occurred. You're asking why Hashem did this? Close your mouth. How can you talk about Hashem? The Karim puts it that way too. So first of all, you have
just
to know.
Why did he suffer?
What's that? Okay. So that's why I'm stressing again. In many cases. Wait. I'm not saying in all cases. The Rambam says it is a question, but it's much more limited than people think. This might not be 70% of the time, but it knocks out a very good percentage of the questions. That's A. B, the Rambam says, see, there are two parts of the question. Why do the righteous suffer? He says, besides the question of whether they cause it to themselves, there are two more things that you have to take into account. First of all, are they righteous? Second of all, are they suffering? There are two premises when you ask why the righteous suffer, the Rambam says. Two premises. First of all, that they're righteous. Second of all, that they're suffering. So, that also you have to know. Is a person truly righteous? Do you really know what's going on with the person? Now, again, there still will be some righteous people who are suffering. But again, not every case where the righteous suffer. Not every time somebody happens to something, can you ask why do good things happen to good people? Maybe the answer is, he's not as good as he thinks and he's not as good as you think. Sometimes it is. Now, sometimes it is a righteous person suffering. Then we have to come on to the Gemara's question. Yes, there is such a thing. But let's realize that the question is not as widespread as it seems. Alright, we'll finish with that. We want to make another couple of points on this next time. Not too much more time on it. And then we'll move on to the session. Okay.